But this is interesting that this can be a protective factor in many ways. Now, this is a study done on more than 20,000 Americans. Again, these are Americans and not Canadians. And this study, published in Demography, which is a very important epidemiological journal, showed that people who attend more than one weekly religious service live 7 years longer than people who do not attend religious services. So they live longer. Yes. I'll talk about spirituality later on. I'll mention it later on. It wasn't covered in this study, but there are other studies. Well, if you're asking, then I'll try to quote. I was in a conference about spirituality and health in the University of Toronto in 2003. And there, a group of researchers from Alberta actually took the National Health Study, the Canadian National Health Study, which encompasses more than 70,000 Canadians. And this is relevant for Canadians. And on that... That year, they analyzed the health survey that was done a few years ago, which actually included factors of spirituality and religiosity. One of the few studies that actually tried to bring apart the effects of spirituality and religiosity. And what they did, they divided people into four groups. People who had both low levels of spirituality and religiosity, you can call them atheists or agnostics or whatever. People with high levels of spirituality and religiosity, the sort of the spiritual religious people. People who had only high levels of religiosity but low levels of spirituality, you can call them ritualists. You know, those that go to shul because they go to shul and not nothing more. And people who had high levels of spirituality with low levels of religiosity. You know, not organized religion, but, you know, some, you know, meditating or whatever. And their outcome, and they looked at mental health outcome and quality of life. And interestingly enough, the people who had higher levels of spirituality or religiosity had the highest scores in terms of mental health and of quality of life. And then came those who had high levels of religiosity and low levels of spirituality. And the third came those with high levels of spirituality but low levels of religiosity. And last were the agnostic and the atheist with low levels of both. So this was, to my knowledge, the only study that really tried to single out the effect, separate the effect of religiosity and spirituality. Although, as I said before, in many ways, the two overlap. In the whole study? Well, the whole survey encompassed 70,000 people. So it's a very strong epidemiological study. Okay, just a few... I don't want to tire you with a lot of numbers because there are a lot of numbers here, so I'll just run them by. I'd like to talk a little about prayer and the effect of prayer on the body. Now, prayer actually elicits a relaxation response, which is the flip side of the stress response. Instead of the body being uptight, it sort of does a flip reaction. That actually activates a parasympathetic nervous system, which causes blood pressure to go down, heart rate to go down, the muscles to relax, the digestive system becomes more, works better, and metabolic rate goes down. So the wear and tear of the relaxation response goes down, and therefore that brings down the risk for disease. And again, this is elicited by prayer. Now, there's a whole body of literature that is very controversial, but there's more and more studies that come up that show that, first of all, people who pray more have lower levels of distress. But there's also research of the effect of distant praying on the health of people who are prayed for. And I hope I brought it along. But before that, I'd like to show you that, as I showed you before, that with technology, we can actually peep into what's happening in the brain, but not only in terms of simple functions of the brain, but also with higher spiritual functions of the brain. And lately, just last year, this is first presented in the NIH. I actually saw the presentation, and last year was actually published. It was a first scan, a PET scan, of the brain while praying. So we have a PET scan of the baseline normal brain without praying, and we have the PET scan with the brain, and there are certain areas that change within the brain, or the metabolism changes within the brain while praying. And these are areas that include the left superior parietal lobe, which is about here, and the right inferior parietal lobe, which is about here. So these areas actually change while praying. So prayer, we can actually see how prayer affects the brain.
I got a question right now.
Go ahead.
Is that prayer like you do in school? Like 90% do, or prayer like you know, reading God
bullets? I think that's prayer.
Which prayer?
Prayer. Not the shul prayer, but prayer. No, but you can really pray in shul sometimes. That's a secret my father told me. Sometimes you can actually pray in shul. It's like a big wine producer at his deathbed brings, you know, calls his sons and say his final words and say, sons, after many years, I have to tell you a big secret. So they come close to his father and he says, you know, you can actually make wine with grapes. So you can actually pray in shul. Okay. So this is one of the interesting studies about praying for patients in an intensive care heart unit. This was published in Southern Medical Journal in 1988. It's a respectable medical journal, and they actually took almost 400 patients and grouped them, divided into two groups. One group was prayed for by a group of people who did not know the patients, and the patients did not know that they were prayed for. And they looked at, and the other group was not prayed for. And they looked at the outcomes, their clinical outcomes. And what was found that the people who were prayed for had better objective medical outcomes. The use of diuretics went down, use of antibiotics, meaning they had less infection in the prayed for group. They needed less intubation. So objective medical outcomes were better in that group. And there were about 16 studies that were that showed the same thing. So I don't attempt scientifically to explain this, and anyone can give an explanation. I think this is beyond the range of science today to explain that effect. But this has caused a lot of turmoil within the scientific medical world, and I think we'll hear a lot more about this. Now, how does spiritual or religious involvement affect health? Well, it's probably multifactorial. There are a lot of factors here, and I'll mention only some. Higher levels of spirituality and religiosity can evoke positive emotions of hope and optimism, and in that way, reduce stress and anxiety, which has a positive health outcome. Also, especially religious involvement has a factor of social support, which we know independently that has a very positive effect on health. For instance, people who have a marriage, and especially if it's a good marriage, have better health outcomes. than people who are alone. And usually religious organizations encourage marriage, and the rate of marriage is higher within these communities. And also, people who have higher levels of religiosity and spirituality have higher health behaviors in terms of less alcoholism, less drugs, dangerous behaviors such as dangerous driving, and so on and so forth. So all these contribute to better health outcomes. This is a study I've done while I was in Baycrest. We looked at mild Alzheimer patients, and we asked ourselves if there's any association between the levels of spirituality and religiosity in these patients and the rate of the cognitive decline of the Alzheimer's patients. So we did this longitudinal study, which lasted for more than 3 years. 68 subjects were included between the ages of 49 and 94, which had Alzheimer's disease, which was done in Baycrest. And we followed their cognitive decline, and we followed their, we determined their levels of spirituality and religiosity using validated scales that are accepted in these kind of studies. And we found that people with higher levels of spirituality and higher levels of private religious activities, okay, these people are people who do not continue to attend religious services, but they kept, some of them kept their religious practices at home, like praying at home and saying graces, brachot, and so on and so forth. People who had higher levels of spirituality and private religious practices had a slower progression of Alzheimer's disease, and this was very significant. The P was smaller than 0.05 for private religious practices and smaller than 0.05 for spirituality. So this is the raw data. And this was presented in the American Academy of Neurology Conference in April this year. And it's very nice that the biggest group in neurology actually accepted this for presentation, which means there is a bigger openness, a greater openness for these kind of studies within the scientific world. So again, spirituality and private religious practices are associated with slower progression of Alzheimer's disease. Those were our conclusions. And our next step would be to do an interventional study, which we would take people with mild Alzheimer's or pre-Alzheimer's state, and we would see if we enhance their spiritual well-being, would that change the course of the disease? So it would be a more active study, and we're actually looking for funding, and if anyone has any idea and would like to contribute, we'd be happy about that. And I think that's very important science, because this really shows that we can actually change the course of disease with enhancing spiritual well-being. I hope that's what we're looking at. That's our hypothesis. Now, are these scientific findings, we're talking about the relationship between body and mind and the effect of spirituality on health, are these new? I think they're not. I think we know them about a few thousand years. And I think the Torah has shown us constantly about the mind-body connections. And every place you open the Torah, you can find these connections. And I won't go into the details. You can hear them on Shabbos when you hear the Torah being read. Maimonides, the Rambam, said that a healthy mind in a healthy body. He was the first psychoneuroimmunologist, I think. So we have this within our... and this is very interesting, this thing. The Maggid of Mezrich, which was a student of the Baal Shem Tov, he said a few hundred years ago that a small hole in the body is or comes from a large hole in the soul. Meaning that the source of disease, the physical body is only a manifestation of the problem itself, which is embedded within the soul. Or, as we would say today, in our psychological and spiritual well-being. That is the source of the problem. So, in order to heal the body, we must first treat or heal the source of the problem, which is embedded within the soul or our psychological and spiritual well-being. And I think this is coming out through research now. I think that science is only in the recent years getting closer to these old or ancient understandings. And I'm actually on the way to a fascinating conference in Miami. If you've heard, that happens once a year in Miami just before Hanukkah. It's called the Torah and Science Conference, where scientists from many areas of science get together and actually show how the advancement in the different scientific areas of science actually brings science closer and closer to ancient Torah understandings in physics and in medicine, ecology, and so on and so forth. Anyone has an opportunity to get some sun in Miami, this is highly recommended. Okay, let me stop here and just a second. There's one more thing that I want to show you, one more slide, and that would be it. I have a lot of slides here, but one more would be enough. Okay, so just to sort of sum up what we've been talking about. Okay, so I think that, again, when we were speaking about medicine, in many ways, this relationship between the patient and the doctor through drugs and surgery, I think is a very, in a way, a superficial way to treat treat disease. Because if we understand that the source of disease through stress, and we understand what we've been talking about, the effect of spirituality on health outcome, we know that the source of the physical problem is, or the physical problem is only a manifestation of the inner problem, which is more psychological and spiritual. And I think that medicine works on this superficial level. Complementary and alternative medicine, I think, has or strives to work in on a deeper level, a more physical, psychological level. But there's also another, even more profound level, which is closer to the source. And this is the psychological, spiritual aspect. And I think if we I'm not saying that we don't have to treat disease on a superficial level. Continue seeing your doctors and taking medications if you need, and surgery, and so on and so forth. I think we have to work in parallel on all levels to effectively treat the problem itself. Because if we do not treat the source of the problem, if we only bandage it in a superficial way, it will show up in a different form. So we have to target the more profound levels of our well-being on a psychological and spiritual aspect. If we don't take care of that, then the physical problem will be there, and if we cover it up, we will find it in a different form. So, again, my recommendation is to work on all levels of our health and well-being, the superficial, intermediate, and more profound, so we can actually achieve higher levels of health. Thank you. Yep.
I'll take a few questions. You know what? If you don't mind, just for the mic, for the tape.
Okay.
Do you think transcendental meditation has any effect on one's well-being?
If he feels good with it, I think it could help. I mean, this is one method for... I mean, if someone is stressed and he does meditation and that helps reduce stress level, then that can be, that's probably good for him. I mean, I think life is a constant search for better and better and more profound ways of enhancing our well-being. So, I mean, I think meditation can be a, you know, if someone discovers meditation is good for him, it could be a stage, you know, in the path of constantly finding things that are better and better and enhances his well-being more and more. So I would say yes if someone feels that it's good for him, but should be open to more and more things that help him. I wouldn't stop just at meditation. Would you like to pass the... Yes.
So just in a practical sense, in your practice as a physician, how did these findings affect your dealings with patients?
Oh, immensely. Again, integrative medicine, I only gave you a few words, but it's a world in itself. When I assess a patient, that's why I don't work with the HMOs. It's a whole geschäft. It's a whole thing. I mean, the first assessment, the first encounter with a patient is usually takes more than an hour, because it's important to get to know the patient, to understand who he is. Who he is as a person, in a holistic way, okay? And it's important to establish a good relationship, because this relationship is a springboard for a positive effect on the health status of a patient. It has so many implications that I don't have time to. And so many effects on how the treatment is. And we're actually in Herzog, what we're doing now. Jen, are you here? Okay, good. Is putting up an integrative health center, a new integrative health center, which will actually treat patients in that mode. And we will... Not only geriatric. No. This is open to the whole public. It's not just psychogeriatric, no. And this is also the connection between conventional medicine and complementary therapies. I don't like the term alternative, because I don't think they are all alternatives. They're complementary, and there are many other factors here that. Yes, please. Let me just bring the microphone. Thank you.
Switch the mic on. Okay. Thanks. Would you say a few words about anger? Because anger is a Jewish no-no. We try to suppress it as much as we can. And yet we teach that we have to get it off our chests. What kind of research do you have to teach us which way to go as clinicians as far as anger is concerned?
Okay. That makes me very angry, that question. No. But, no. Anger is a form of stress, okay? And people express stress in different ways, okay? One tends to be, you know, sad. The other tends to be angry. When you refer, what caught me in your question is suppressing anger. Suppressing anger is very bad for your health, I think. I mean, expressing anger too much is also bad, but I don't think it's Jewish to suppress anger, because trying to suppress anger will cause such an internal turmoil, you know. So I think the way is not to suppress it in a way. Yes, sorry.
Thanks. If you buy the hypothesis that anger is merely a response, a defensive response to a feeling of threat or vulnerable feelings, and if you look for the vulnerable feelings beneath the anger and express those, then you don't need the anger.
Right, right. That's a strategy to overcome it in a way. Yeah. There are other strategies too. But it would take another hour to explain other strategies. Okay. But I think it's one of the strategies. I agree.
Okay. So my question is, do you have any evidence from your studies?
Yes. Yeah. There are actually studies on the anger form of stress as associated with worse health outcomes. Yes, there are studies that show that.
Of the expression of anger.
Also,
or the suppression.
No, it's anger in general. I don't know if they. I can't think now of any research that differentiate between suppression and expression. But I think there are some. I just can't recall them all. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. But I can look that up if you want later on. Yes, please.
I just wanted to ask you, please, which stress-reducing techniques have you found to be the most effective?
That's a good question. I've myself done a technique that's called mindful awareness. It's very popular in Israel. When I was here in Toronto, we taught it. Again, it will take an hour to sort of try to explain what it is. But there are many ways of doing this. There are many systems, and I think that we have. What do you do? What was it? Do you want to say a few words about your system? And yeah. What's the name of the method?
I have my own system,
yes.
But my company is the Relaxation Response Institute.
Mm-hmm.
But I teach people how to skillfully regulate themselves.
Right.
It's not difficult,
right.
But it takes training and practice.
Thank you. So there are many ways to do this. What we do, we have in the integrative clinic, we have several methods. We have meditation, we have homeopathy, we have Chinese medicine, we have support groups, and so on and so forth. There's several. We tailor the specific therapies for the specific patient, and it's, you know, I can't say this is good for everyone. It depends on the person. We try to channel people to the things that we think that would help the most. So there's a whole array, a whole arsenal of methods to reduce stress and to reduce anger. That's exactly what we do in integrative medicine. That's what we do in our clinic. This is new in Israel. I'm not aware of any of such a clinic quite like this in Canada, but I'm open to these. I just visited in UCLA, the UCSF in San Francisco. Within the University Hospital, they have a center called the Osher Center, which is an integrative clinic. I'll be in New York next week, so hope to see other integrative clinics there. They're popping up over the all over the states, so it's becoming more a stronger trend. I think this is a very positive motion within medicine, and I think we'll see more of that. Yes.
So my question to you is, you've discussed spirituality and religion. What is the scientific difference between both? I mean, what is the definition you have for each one?
Well, the definition, just a sort of brief definition, spirituality is some kind of a connection with the divine, supernatural divine, I would say. And religion is more related to a sort of organizational form of spirituality, I'd say. Okay, a sort of more organized spirituality.
So it seems to me, based on the stats that you gave us earlier, that the religious aspect is more intellectual. So it seems to me that the mind has a greater effect on the effects of reducing stress, because if in the meditative state, it's more of a relaxation which deals with the body, and the religious aspect seems to me more intellectual. Am I right in assuming that?
Well, it depends. See, that's a very important. I think that's a very interesting and important thing. it seems that it's not enough only to do the religious rituals as a ritual, but it seems that the maximum outcome in terms of the effect on stress comes from a spiritual religiosity, I would say. So it's not only doing the rituals, which also have an effect, but it's doing the rituals with in a very spiritual way, you know, a very inner way, I would say. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's not only doing the rituals, but it's how you do the rituals. If you pray in a meditative way and you're really connected, then that has a maximum effect in terms of stress reduction, and also, you know, it has a spiritual effect and an emotional effect and a cognitive effect and so on and so forth. But if you only say the words without being, without relating to the words, without relating to what you're doing, then I'm sure that has a lower effect, a weaker effect on someone's being, although it does still have an effect. That's my hunch on this.
I'd like to thank you and congratulate you on illuminating and formalizing something that I seem to have discovered almost instinctually. I try to practice medicine in, similarly to the way you've described, but not to a complete extent. And I find that you actually can't afford to do that in our system unless you're already retired, which I am. And patient after patient says, nobody's ever asked me those questions before, and I feel so much better. And it really is effective, I have to agree with you. But I have a question relating to these studies you've done on religiosity and the brain function. I believe that there's a very similar body of knowledge being pursued in relationship with music and brain function. And I'm wondering if you're aware of how much these resemble each other or how different they might be.
Well, I'm not familiar with all the research on music effect. I know that there are some studies on music and Alzheimer's disease. I know that especially moderate to severe Alzheimer's patients, you know, especially with behavioral problems, can have a benefit from music therapy. I think one of the unique aspects of religiosity is that the effect of religiosity is that it is so multifactorial, because again you have the emotional aspect of hope and optimism, you have the social aspects, you have the behavioral or health behavioral aspects, cognitive, emotional, you know, and so on. So it's in a way you get a lot of aspects within one sort of entity, so it works in many, many ways, in a sense. Music is also effective, but the question is, does music affect all the aspects, all the different aspects, as religiosity does? I don't know. I'm just asking. I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure it does. Yes.
Hi. There's a little device that is manufactured and invented in Israel called the Respirate Machine, which helps train people as an individual breath coach and works for lowering blood pressure. I was curious about the whole idea that it was coming out of Israel and wondering whether, in fact, in the Jewish tradition, what are we thinking about breath? Is this something you're knowledgeable about, how Torah speaks about breath, the medicinal impact of breath, so to speak? Do we have a context for this?
I think our deeper understandings of how breathing affects, you know, spiritually our whole being relates to the more deeper understanding of Torah, or the inner understanding of Torah, which comes out of the Kabbalah and even Hasidus understanding, because they sort of tap into the more profound aspects of what each part of the body resembles. And, well, I can go into the lung in Hebrew is called Re'ah. Re'ah is the lung in Hebrew, the name for Re'ah. Re'ah are the same letters of the word Re'ah. Re'ah is sight, or a spiritual sight. And also Yir'ah. Yir'ah is the same letters, how do you say, fear and awe. So again, just looking, you know, Hebrew is unique in the sense that every letter and every word has a root, a spiritual root. So you can take the word re'ah, lung, and actually go down to the spiritual root of what it stands for. And from there you understand the essence of what it means to breathe. Nishima is the word for breathing. And it's the same letters as neshama, which is the soul. So again, the connection between breathing and reaching into the soul. Okay, so just looking at the Hebrew words, you can actually understand the meanings and the connections. So there's a lot there.
I think we'll have our last question, then we'll do with everything here privately. So if you want
Okay.
Further along in the Torah section here, can you actually derive any therapies from your reading of Chumash? Mineral supplements, nachash, copper, zinc. Does this actually have any practical application to medicine, or is it just a matter of understanding and on the one hand and believing on the other?
It does have clinical implications. I think we have to do a lot more to deepen our understandings. I know there were very high, scholars, Torah scholars, that made diagnosis and understood a person's, health problems through reflecting through the Torah understandings. And they were asked, how do they know? And they said, they thought this was a miracle, how they could diagnose and find the right remedy. But they said that it's not that, I did something special, just from knowing the Torah in very deep details, I can actually, perceive the right remedy and the right diagnosis. So there are people who make these connections, and I think that my personal goal is to expand and deepen my knowledge into the inner profound aspects or understanding of the Torah so I can enhance my understandings of what my patients have and treat that more effective. I think within the Torah, we have those answers and we have to, renew our understanding. Some of these understandings have, gone away, that are lost over the ages, but we can, find them and dig them out again. That is my personal goal, and I'm, and I think a lot of people are engaged. I mean, a lot of people deal with the Rambam's remedies, and people in Israel, there's a lot of work on people actually using Rambam's studies. The Rambam took most of his knowledge from the Torah itself. So it's reliving, things that have been forgotten. It's now a time of renewal of these understandings. So there's a lot being done in that sense, and I hope to learn much more about that. That's a very important issue.
Our real last question.
And then the real one.
I have a question about removing oneself from stressors as a technique for reducing stress.
Good luck.
One aspect of that is,
lived in Israel?
Well, yeah, it's an issue, obviously.
In Canada, it's easier, maybe.
That's definitely true, definitely true. In order to practice many stress reduction techniques, one must first remove oneself from the stressor, because you can't do both at the same time, except in a few instances, which I'm hoping you can share with us. What kinds of techniques are available to practice while in the midst of a stressor?
I think that, I mentioned before that I learned for more than 10 years a technique which is called mindful awareness. And that technique allows you to in a way, be detached from stress in the midst of the stressor itself. As we know, two people can be in the midst of a very big objective source of stress. but both of them have different responses. One can function, you know, with great, you know, you can even be in a state of, you know, act smoothly and not be stressed about it, and one can be totally overwhelmed. So it's not the objective, quote unquote, stress, because stressors are all around always. That's almost the essence of life, in a way. It's not the external environment, it's more the internal environment, how we react to different stressors. You know that in very calm environments, like countries like Scandinavia, there are a lot of people, Scandinavia, people are very stressed there and commit a lot of suicide, and there's a lot of depression there, okay? So, and you can find battle zones where people are not as depressed and don't commit suicide and maybe even have higher well-being, rates of well-being. So again, it's not the external environment, it's how we change and affect our internal environment. And we have the ability to change the internal environment through conscious awareness. That's at least one method that, you know, I know of. Unfortunately, I don't have knowledge of it being taught in North America, but you're welcome to Israel.
Thank you very much, really, for a most enlightening and stress-relieving presentation. It was really quite enjoyable. Thank you. I want to thank Herzog Hospital and the Jewish Health Alliance. And I just want to make, on behalf of Torah Motion, just announce we're going to be having on the 25th of December, I don't think anybody is working then, it's also a Sunday this year, we're going to be having our third annual program on Judaism and Christianity. It's going to be here in the shul. So that you can mark on your calendar if you haven't already. And I want to wish everybody a good night and thank everybody for coming. And let's keep our stress levels down. Thanks a lot.